Continuing in the second chapter, and now Shvetashvatara Rishi is going to begin describing in some detail, at least give us an outline of the meditational process of yoga. Of course, the particular process always varies from age to age. And at any given time, there may be several different bona fide processes available. So the one kind of meditation taught here is just a prototype. We have to understand the essential principles being taught and apply them to whatever method of yoga we're practicing. Text number 6. Okay, well, if anyone's here, I'll make the announcement for the midterm examination, but we won't have a test. I'm assigning a paper. I'll give you the topic right now, and you have until class time on Friday to turn the paper in. And it doesn't have to be long. Depending on what size paper you use, 1 to 3 pages, at least 3 good paragraphs. Just take as long as you need to explain what you have to say. Consider like this. Suppose you are Shvetashvatara Rishi, and you're being interviewed for a newspaper, and you're being asked a few questions. So, as Shvetashvatara Rishi, you should try to explain things simply and clearly, just the basic points, so that ordinary newspaper reader, audience of newspaper readers can understand what you're saying. And the questions you're asked are, the reporter's asking you simply, what is the purpose of this Upanishad, your Shvetashvatara Upanishad? What are you teaching, and who are you teaching it to? Purpose of your Upanishad, teaching what and to whom? And just putting yourself in the role of the author or the rishi, just try to explain things, basic, important ideas, and explain them simply and clearly. You don't have to present all the details you can think of. Just explain what's important. Massive details is not what we're looking for. We're looking for a clear, basic explanation of the important ideas. You can look at your book, you can look at whatever notes you've taken, but please don't discuss with anyone else in the class what they've done. Don't look at anybody else's work, and don't show your paper to anybody else. Okay, after I've graded them and handed them back, then you can discuss with each other. But for now, work on your own. That's the only restriction. Yes. Yeah. If you want to, you can hand it in before, but it's due on Friday at class. Okay, so reading text 6. Agnir yatra vimatyate, vayur yatra rudyate, somo yatra vichyate, tatra sanjayate manaha. This verse is explaining the prerequisite conditions for meditating. And there's two different interpretations given in this verse. My translation is based on one of them. And I'll explain both. So the translation I have. When a person has evoked the presence of the super soul's fire by the sacrificial churning, when he has brought his life air under control, and when the deity's soma exhibits his pure potency, then the aspirant's mind can awake in meditation. So these are prerequisites to being able to actually engage in serious meditation. Before we had verses describing chanting Om, using the transcendental sound of the syllable Om to evoke the presence of the super soul within the heart. And the metaphor was given of the sacrificial lighting of the sacrificial fire by rubbing the arani sticks. By this process of friction, the sacrificial fire is produced. Similarly, by the friction of the transcendental sound of Om, the Supreme Lord is made manifest in the heart. So, abhimanyate, churning. We're not talking about churning butter, we're talking about churning the kindling sticks to make fire, sacred fire. We have to practice hearing and chanting in order to evoke the presence of the Supreme in the heart. And also, the second line stipulates of meditational yoga, Ashtanga yoga. This is referring to pranayama, the physical exercises for restraining, for controlling the breath. That controls the consciousness. We can understand that more generally as bringing the wild senses that are demanding gratification under control. When a person becomes peaceful in Krishna consciousness, his senses become calm. That's another form of pranayama, bringing the life air under control. The materialist is life air is out of control. His senses, impelled by the vital air, are jumping at every opportunity for sense gratification. Whereas a serious sadhu has his senses and his life air under control, restricted. Third line says where, this is a little more esoteric, when soma becomes exalted or powerful, anivichite. Soma, of course, has meanings on different levels. Soma is the sacred plant offered in the soma sacrifice. By drinking the soma juice, you can go to become a demigod. But soma is also the presiding deity of the moon. His name is Soma or Chandra. And he produces the soma plant. But soma, the lord of the moon, is also the moon lord, the ruling deity of the mind. So this phrase, when the deity soma exhibits his pure potency, that's talking about the purification of the mind. Then one's spiritual consciousness can begin to manifest. When one has achieve these qualifications. So that's one explanation. But according to Rang Ramanuja, the Sri Vaishnav older commentary, this is more simply a discussion of where, what's the proper place to sit down and practice meditation. Agnya Yatra Bhimatyate, in the place where fire is kept away. Where meaning the wind doesn't blow too strong, and therefore there's no danger of a forest fire or some other fire disturbing your meditation. Where fire is kept away is one thing, and when the wind doesn't blow too heavily is the second line. So there's no danger of disturbance from fire or wind. A peaceful place is where you should meditate. And then it says, somo yatradi vichite, where soma is also absent. And Rang Ramanuja gives an esoteric meaning of the word soma to mean snow, ice, where the weather is not too cold. So you should find a comfortable place, a place with moderate weather and not too much disturbance to practice meditation. That's the other interpretation, if you want to choose that one. There's a similar verse in the 11th canto, Krishna's teachings to Lord Uddhava. It's not in the book. I've left this one out, but I'll read it. 11th canto, chapter 14, verse 25. Yatagni na hema malam jahati Dhamatam bhunatsvam bhajate charupam atma chakarma nushayam vidhuya madbhakti yogena bhajatyato mam. Just as gold, when smelted in fire, gives up its impurities and returns to its pure, brilliant state, similarly the spirit soul, absorbed in the fire of bhakti yoga, is purified of all contamination caused by previous fruitive activities and returns to its original position of serving me in the spiritual world. Okay, I'll move on to the next verse. Any questions before that? Okay, verse 7. Savitra prasavena jusheta brahmapura viam tatra yonim grinvase nahite purtim akshipat. Having received the sanction of the inspirer of all, you should begin worshipping that primeval Lord. You should prepare your heart for the Supreme's appearance there, assured that he will not deny your desire's fulfillment. This verse repeats some ideas from before, with reference to Savita, the inspirer. That's Savita, understood sometimes as the sun god, but we also are taking it here to mean the Supreme Lord who inspires everyone's intelligence and gives everyone life. And we chant the Gayatri Mantra, the first Gayatri Mantra to Savita. It's not just a prayer to the sun god, but a prayer to Lord Narayana, the super soul. Prasava can mean inspiration. Here we're taking it to mean permission. When the Lord gives his blessings, then you can begin seriously the process of meditation. Jusheta, he should be worshipped. That is the purpose, according to this statement, of engaging in this process. It's meant for worshipping the Supreme. The worship is in the form of meditation, but the word Jush means to worship. Purvyam is the original. That word was, at the beginning of the chapter, used to describe the Lord as the primeval person who precedes everyone else. Then it says, Tatra Yonim Krim Vase. Yoni means womb. Here it means place of manifestation. You should prepare the place for his manifestation in your heart. You should make your heart ready to receive him. And then be assured. Don't be frustrated. Don't be impatient. You can be confident. Nahite purtim akshipat. He's not going to neglect fulfilling your desires. You just have to follow the process and be a little patient. So in the beginning of the chapter, there was glorification of the Supreme Person and also description of how one should honor the pure devotees of the Lord who are his representatives. That was described in the second verse. So thus, one should offer respects to his own spiritual master and to the other previous acharyas and offer glorification to the Supreme Lord. Then he can begin his meditation. The Lord will give his kind permission, and then one can actually begin serving him and meditating upon him. The second commentary by Nitya Gopal Panchatirtha of the Gaudiya Math. He gives a second interpretation of this verse, that it might be looked at as describing worshipping the sun god, Savita, because he and the other demigods, especially the sun god, help you enter devotional service. The sun god is Savita because he is the inspirer of the world. The sun, with its light, is giving life, literally, to the whole world, with the light and heat that it provides, the radiant energy. with his help, with the help of the sun god that gives you the power of sight, and the other gods that give you the power of hearing and speaking and so on, one can begin the process of devotional service. And what's the benefit of this? According to this commentary, Nahite Purtim Akshipat. Instead of, a different interpretation of that line, meaning that your Purtim, your deeds, what you have done in the past, won't be a disturbance for you, an obstacle for you anymore. The karma ajnana, which is your bondage, you'll become free from that bondage, from the bondage of your previous entanglement in fruitive work and mental speculation, if you engage in this process of devotional meditation. These verses describe Agni and then the sun. We can understand this as, according to Bhakti Sri Rupa Siddhanti Maharaj from the Gaudiya Mutt, that the fire god and the sun god both, they provide illumination, they give us light. And we can understand in terms of enlightenment, spiritual knowledge also. There's some description here from Bhakti Sri Rupa Siddhanti Maharaj of the three different manifestations of the sun god Agni. He appears in three different ways in this world. Agni, and he also has, according to the Bhagavatam, three sons with these three names. Shuchi, Pavamana, and Pavaka. I'll write the names down. This is not that important to remember. I'm curious here.
These are three manifest aspects of the sun, of the fire god. And they appear as his three sons, his three first sons. He had 49 sons, but they're the first three.
And explanation is, fire in the sun is called Shuchi. Fire as manifest in the sun planet is called Shuchi, the light of the sun. Fire that appears on the earth, like the fire, the sacred fire that's produced by the churning, or just the fire in your kitchen, that is called Pavamana, earthly fire. And the fire of lightning, electrical fire, is called Pavaka. This Pavaka fire, the sun is the origin, the shelter of all three kinds. He's the original light. So the fire god manifests in the sun under the name Shuchi. In the sacrificial context, he appears under the name Pavamana. And then the electrical fire is appearing in the atmosphere, in the storms. He's also appearing inside the living entities. The nervous electrical energy of the living body is the manifestation of Pavaka. And also in the living bodies, at least at the map of the more advanced living beings, there is the fire of digestion. That is Pavaka under the special name Vaishvanara, the fire in every man, Vishvanara, every person has this fire in his stomach. Krishna says, "Aham Vaishvanara Bhutva." I am this Vaishvanara, and I help everyone digest their food. And the last comment is that this Vaishvanara is found in the Muladhara chakra, the lowest chakra, center of energy in the body, and it cooperates with the air, the breathing, the air of breath, to regulate or to give the energy of life. This Vaishvanara energy, this third manifestation in its special aspect of the fire and stuff, it's actually has its base on the lowest energy level chakra in the body, the Muladhara chakra, which is at the bottom of the spine, and it works together with the air of breath. all the active functions of the living being are produced by that cooperation. Yes, ma'am.
Are these different fires?
These are different aspects of fire, different manifestations of the power of fire.
Are they different manifestations of Agni, or are they different people?
Both. They're Agni's aspect of his personality, but they appear as his son separately also. Okay. And then from the spiritual point of view, we can understand, by the grace of the sun god, fire is kindled in our heart in the form of spiritual knowledge. And that knowledge burns our karmic entanglement to ashes. Then when karma is eliminated, one can have real understanding of the nature of the self. After your karmic entanglement is dissolved or burnt. Then you don't have an inclination to engage in sense gratification anymore. And you can take shelter of the Supreme Lord and engage in His service. Another comment here. We can understand that we have subtle and gross bodies. There's two subtle bodies, not often discussed, not discussed in the Bhagavatam. We have this mental body, of mind and intelligence, but there's also, you can separately conceive of the ego body as the most subtle body. It's also called the Karana Sharira. Even the universe has three bodies. There's Brahma in his gross body with four heads sitting on a lotus. He's, in a sense, he's the soul of the whole universe, the jiva soul of the universe. There's a more subtle body of Brahma. He's the Lord of the Mahatattva. And there's a third, most subtle, called Hiranyagarbha. He's actually has his body in false ego. Anyway, that's a little complicated, but every living entity, every jiva, also has those three bodies. So karma destroys your gross body. By appropriate karma, you get your present body replaced with a better body, a body in heaven or somewhere else. Or by inappropriate karma activity, you get an animal body or a body in hell. So your body is destroyed. Your physical gross body is destroyed by karma. Your subtle body, mental body, is destroyed by jnana. By transcendental knowledge, you can gain liberation. There's dissolution of the subtle body. But the karana sharira, the most subtle body, the body of pure of ego, is only dissolved by devotional service. Okay, that final knot of attachment cannot be dissolved by just knowledge. Okay, that's verse 7.
Verse 8?
What we call the causal body, or the body of ego, that's destroyed only by devotional service. Causal. Just like, you know, the most subtle cause of existence is ego. But it's called the causal body because it's more subtle than the ordinary subtlest cause. Text 8. Now we're getting into physical description of how to sit and meditate. Trir unattam stavyam samam shariram vidindriyani manasa sannivesya vamorupena patarita vidvan srotamsi sarvani vayavahani. The wise person should hold his body straight, keeping forward his chest, neck, and head. He should gather together his mind and senses within the heart, and with the boat of transcendental sound, he should cross each of the fearful rivers of his material life. So this is describing method, in some detail, of gradual 8 steps of yoga meditation leading to samadhi. This is the samadhi that was described or stated in the previous verse. One should prepare his heart for the manifestation of the Lord. This is the process of preparing. this eightfold method of yoga. So this verse particularly describes the two stages of asana and pratyahara. Physical postures, which is described as simply holding your neck, chest, neck and head straight. And then pratyahara, which is withdrawing the senses from their objects, bringing your consciousness inward and refraining from sense gratification. So the asana, the proper posture, these three limbs, the chest, neck, and head should be held straight, and they shouldn't be moving. They shouldn't be agitated and moving. Also, the dharana process is being described here. Fixing one's mind firmly on the Supreme, where it says, Riddhi Indriyani, one should gather together his mind and senses within the heart. According to Rung Ramanuja, that means fixing one's mind and senses on the personality of Godhead, the Supreme Brahman, who is there in the heart. We're not talking about an impersonal mechanical process of just negatively withdrawing the senses and forcing them to concentrate on some physical organ. We're talking about finding the Paramatma within the heart. One has to then practice, by Brahma. Brahma here means the sound of the Vedas. It's also called Brahman. Vedic transcendental sound. By chanting Om or by other hearing and chanting, one should, the wise, intelligent person, should cross over all the fearful rivers of material existence. These are his engagements in sense gratification and mental speculation in various forms. They're called fearful because karma and jnana entanglement can lead to birth as a ghost or an animal. They're called rivers because just like rivers, they flow downstream. They lead to a lower existence, to degradation. One should cross over these rivers and start moving in the opposite direction, upstream. Okay, now there is... Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, these are the various kinds of entanglement in your material life. And they come in the two forms of jnana and karma. Just like Krishna says, svalpamapyasya dharmasya trayate mahato bhayat. Even a little engagement in devotional service saves one from the greatest kind of fear. The fear is becoming entangled. Well, the fear is taking birth in a lower form of life. But that comes from being entangled in karma or jnana. You can become an animal by practicing jnana too. Just like all these pigs and birds in Vrindavan, many of them were Mayavadis in their previous lives. You know, they came here and they committed offenses against the Lord and they took birth in lower species. Vrindavan is popular among all the transcendentalists, including the Mayavadis. It's one of the four dhams, so everybody comes here, including the offenders. Okay, so there's some discussion here in the Vedanta Sutra, as explained by Baladeva Vidyabhushan in the second chapter of the Vedanta Sutra. Second chapter shows how the Siddhanta, the consistent philosophy presented by the Upanishads, is not contradicted by other evidence. First of all, it shows that other philosophies can't disprove the Vedanta philosophy, that it stands undefeatable by other philosophies. And each other philosophy is dealt with one by one. So in the discussion, first of all, Sankhya philosophy, the materialistic, atheistic Sankhya, which is based on the idea that everything that exists is a combination of two basic principles, nature and the Purusha, Prakriti and Purusha. But it's not the same idea of prakriti and purusha that we learned from our philosophy. According to the materialistic or the atheistic Samkhya philosophy, material nature is the origin of everything. But she has no consciousness. She's active. Everything happens by her impulse, but she doesn't have consciousness. The purusha, the living being, is conscious, but he's inactive. In the literal sense, he doesn't perform any activity. And only by the combination of the two does material existence occur. And when the two are separated, material existence dissolves. There's no personal conception of liberation. It's just a dissolution, obliteration. So that philosophy is rejected by Vyasadeva very strongly in the Vedanta Sutra. And then he goes on, after defeating that, to also defeat the presentation of yoga philosophy by Patanjali Rishi. But then, at this point, which is the beginning, the third verse of the first section of the second chapter, someone questions, well, yes, it's true that the Sankhya, the scriptures taught by the acharyas of Sankhya philosophy, they cannot contradict Vedanta. This philosophy is faulty. Materialistic Sankhya philosophy is faulty, and it stands against the principles of Vedanta, so therefore it's rejected. But we don't need, someone suggests, we don't need to reject yoga philosophy because it doesn't say anything against Vedanta. It doesn't contradict Vedanta. Why not accept it also? And as evidence for that suggestion, it said, well, there's statements in Shruti recommending and describing yoga, as in the Kathopanishad. Tam yogam iti. These verses I'm reading here are on the pages here, if you want to follow them, on page 27. Tam yogam iti manyante stiram indriyadharanam. This firm control of the senses is considered yoga, from Kathopanishad. And also Kathopanishad, vidyame tam yoga vidyam chakritsnam. Nachiketa received from Yamaraj this method of meditation and the process of yoga. So there are many descriptions of yoga in the Kathopanishad and others. And here, then it refers to what we just read in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Trir unatam stapishanam shariram. There is some detailed description of the process of the proper postures, the process of asana, and so on. So even the method in detail of yoga is presented in the Upanishads. So the person is suggesting further, the great sage Patanjali, who was very authoritative, compassionately wanted to relieve the world of its suffering, so he presented the Yoga Shastras. The Shastras begin with the sutra, Atta Yoga Anushasanam. It's like Atato Brahma Gigyasa. So Atta, now we will teach yoga. Yoga Chitta Nirodha. And yoga basically means controlling the mind. And Yoga Sutra starts from that point. So, if, as you're suggesting in this Vedanta Sutra, we should take the Vedanta or the Upanishads and explain how they're all the Upanishads are simply talking about the absolute truth and nothing else. That is the one important topic of the Upanishads. If you want to follow that interpretation and just try to show how everything in the Upanishads talks about the absolute truth, you're not going to leave any opportunity to show how the yoga philosophy is taught in the Upanishads. Because the yoga shastras talk about how to practice yoga. They don't talk about the absolute truth. So you're not being fair. you want to leave out the description of yoga from the Upanishads. Just ignore it as unimportant. And you have other scriptures like the Smritis, books presented by various other sages. Patanjali wrote his Yoga Sutra, but you're being unfair. You're neglecting the Yoga Sutra in your explanation of Vedanta, but you're relying on other Smritis like the Manu Samhita, Dharma Shastra written by Manu and other sages. You have plenty of opportunity to discuss that in your Vedanta Sutra, these different Smritis, because they describe the same kind of Dharma that you want to describe. Therefore, we suggest that you explain the Upanishads on the basis of the yoga scriptures, not on the basis of your theoretical analysis of how everything is describing the Absolute Truth. That is the what's called Purva Paksha. That's the other side's suggestion. Now, the sutra is spoken by Vyasadeva to answer that suggestion. Etena yoga pratyuktaha. Translation of that. By this refuting of the Samkhya Smriti, the Yoga Smriti is also refuted. That's Vyasadeva's answer. We just defeated the Samkhya philosophy. Well, that same argument also defeats the Yoga philosophy. So Baladevi Bhushan explains this. By this refutation of Samkhya philosophy, Yoga philosophy is also, we should understand Yoga philosophy is also defeated. Because Yoga philosophy as presented by Patanjali Rishi is contradictory to the principles of Vedanta in the same way. If we're going to try to explain the Upanishads on the basis of the Yoga scriptures, then the other smritis, like the Manu Samhita and other books composed by great sages, will have no opportunity to employ them. And don't think that the Yoga scripture doesn't contradict the Vedanta. It certainly does. For example, the Yoga scripture of Patanjali says that pradan, material nature, is the independent cause of all existence by herself. The Yoga Shastra also says that both God and the Jiva are simply pure spirit, and they're both expansions of material nature. Material nature is the cause of God and the Jiva, according to the Yoga scripture of Patanjali. And then you say the only means of becoming free from unhappiness is to practice this yoga. So these and other things that are said contradict the philosophy of Vedanta. Therefore, we can't accept them. So this being the case, you know, that we can't accept yoga scripture as authoritative because it contradicts the principles of Vedanta, we have to understand what these statements in the Upanishads that are describing yoga are saying. Like in the statement Triya Urnatam in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, that one should sit to meditate holding his neck, body, neck, and head in a straight line, and so on. There's just specific description of how one should practice the meditational postures. And there's other statements. There's a statement later on in the sixth chapter of the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. Tatkaranam Sankhya Yogadi Gamyam. That Brahman is the supreme cause that is learned in the scriptures of Sankhya and Yoga. That is learned by the process of Sankhya and Yoga. So Shvetashvatara Upanishad says you learn about Brahman through the processes of Sankhya and Yoga, but the knowledge that one acquires by Sankhya, by analytic study of the universe, and the meditation that one develops by practicing yoga, these are not the same processes that are taught in the atheistic Sankhya system and in Patanjali's yoga. These are different. These are authorized processes. Vedantic, on the basis of Vedanta philosophy. You're not going to become self-realized or realize God. Let me just get to the end of this two sentences. You're not going to attain self-realization or realization of God just by theoretically understanding the difference between Prakriti and Purusha on some speculative basis. There's more to spiritual realization than that, and knowledge has to have a different basis than that. And you don't actually get liberation just by practicing the yoga taught by Patanjali. The real methods of jnana and yoga are described in the Upanishads. Tameva viditva atimrityumeti, Shvetashvatara Upanishad, 3rd chapter. Only by knowing that Supreme Person can you transcend death. Not by some mere theoretical purusha. Vigyaya pragyam kurvita, Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad. One can act on the platform of full intelligence only after achieving true spiritual realization of the Supreme Brahman. And etadyo dhyayati rasati bhajati somvito bhavati. This is the description of real yoga practice from the Gopal Tapani Upanishad. One who meditates on him, Govinda, relishes his transcendental dealings and worships him, will become immortal. That is actual yoga practice. That's not what Patanjali teaches. Anyway, that's Baladeva Jibhushan's Govinda Bhasha, those verses, for that sutra. I'm sorry, you heard a comment? We don't know. Sometimes it's before Kali Yuga. Very ancient sages. Each of the six schools of philosophy has the original sutras written by an important sage, and we don't know how old they are. Each of these sutras are. They're from before Kali Yuga.
Is it part of the
Vedas? No. First of all, they're smriti because they were written by living beings, by sages. So they're not eternal. Just like we follow our philosophy as Vedanta, we follow Vedanta Sutra, written by Vyasadeva. That's not the only attempt to formulate Vedanta philosophy. Vyasadeva himself quotes from previous authors. That means there were other versions of Vedanta before him, in previous ages. So different sages can formulate these philosophies and write sutras in different ages. It's not, they're not considered eternal. But it's so old. Each of these sutras for each of the six philosophies are so old we don't know when they were written. Doesn't mean they're eternal, though. Just very old. At least 5,000 years old.
Which six philosophies?
Well, we just mentioned two. Yoga and Sankhya. How much time we have. You can, to simplify the six philosophies, you can pair them up. There are three pairs. They're called sister philosophies because they work together. Just like we have Vedanta philosophy, which describes the Supreme Person and devotional service to him. That's Vedanta philosophy. But the sister philosophy that goes together with Vedanta philosophy is Karma Mimamsa, taught by Jaimini Rishi. Because Jaimini Rishi explained the Vedas. Both of these philosophies are based on the Vedic scripture. But Jaimini explained the Vedas from the point of view of ritual sacrifices. That was his whole focus. Vyasadeva focused on the Upanishads and explained the absolute truth. But they go together. They're both based on the Vedas. You could say that one of them, of the two philosophies, explains the theory and the other the practice. Or one of them explains how to acquire knowledge, the means of knowledge, and the other one explains the means of proper activity. Because Jaimini in his Karma Mimamsa Sutras explains how to interpret the Vedas, how to take the mantras of the Vedas and understand what they're telling you to do. There are rules of interpretation given by Jaimini. The bulk of what he's talking, what he describes, is how to interpret the exact meaning of every mantra, exactly what it's telling you to do. You know, every step of the ritual, how to interpret. So that's goes together with Vedanta. Vedanta is based on understanding the Upanishads and other Vedic literatures. You have to use the same rules of interpretation to understand the meaning of the Upanishads. So even though the focus of the Karma Mimamsa school was ritualistic, we are not interested in that, but we're very happy to take advantage of the technique taught by Jaimini, how to interpret the scriptures. So the two philosophies are sister philosophies, they work together. Similarly, the Sankhya and Yoga philosophy work together. Sankhya philosophy presents a theoretical explanation of the universe in terms of Prakriti and Purusha. Yoga philosophy uses that explanation of the world and on the basis of it teaches the process of self-realization by Patanjali's yoga. They go together, theory and practice. And there's two other philosophies, Nyaya and Vaisheshika. Nyaya philosophy teaches logic, but not only logic. It teaches the science of knowledge in general. Logic is one way of knowing. You can also know by direct perception, by using your senses, and also third way, logic is the second way. Third means of knowing is hearing from authorities. So Nyaya discusses that whole science of knowledge, epistemology, taught by Gautama Rishi. And together with that, the sister philosophy is Vaisheshika philosophy. That's atomic theory, or theory of physical analysis of the universe, taught by Kanada Rishi. But based on the logical analysis, the physical explanation of the universe, like a scientific explanation, based on the logic of Gautama Rishi, two go together. So those are the six philosophies. The original sutras are very ancient, but we have many commentaries on each of these philosophies, which we do know the dates of. They all begin around the 1st century AD. People started writing commentaries on these sutras. Older commentaries are lost. Shankara is not the same as Sankhya. Shankaracharya, he took the Vedanta Sutra and explained them, so he belongs to the Vedanta category. But he presented an intentional misinterpretation of Vedanta.
So you explained that Yoga Sutra is
well, very complicated terms. Yeah.
Is it a personal philosophy?
It talks about Purusha supposedly. The person. But that person is not a person in the sense that we know. He's sort of just he's a person who can't do anything. You know, he has consciousness, but he has no activity. He's just, a helpless puppet in the hands of material nature. And his liberation is to just go out of existence. Well, his liberation is to go back to his pure state of being pure, of being only consciousness. That means in the state of liberation, the living entity does nothing. Now he's conscious, but he can't do anything with his consciousness. That's not our idea of what it really means to be a person. So it is impersonal. And all the philosophies other than Vedanta are atheistic. None of the philosophies other than Vedanta, based on the Upanishads and explained by Vyasadeva, none of the other of these six philosophies actually accept the personal concept of the Supreme. They all either give some lip service or are openly atheistic. And none of the others properly have proper faith in the authority of the Vedas. Even Jaimini is not understanding the essence of the Vedas. He's giving a ritualistic interpretation, but that's not the real message of the Vedas. Okay, let's see if we can cover another verse. Maybe two. Yeah, please. Well, we should sit some of the time. We have to get up to do our service, but we should sit down According to Manusmriti, when you chant your Gayatri in the morning, when you chant Gayatri in the evening, you should sit down. When you chant, according to Manu, in the Manusmriti, when you chant your first Gayatri, you have to stand up. Because otherwise your prana won't wake up. If you're sitting, your prana will stay asleep. And in the morning, in the evening, when you chant your last Gayatri, if you don't sit down to chant your Gayatri, your prana won't go to sleep and you won't be able to sleep at night. No, noon he doesn't specify. That's he didn't regulate that. So you know, we have to sit down at least when we chant our Gayatri in the evening. Yes, just like we should, you know, when we're sitting in Bhagavatam class, you should sit properly. Prabhupada Japa tape, he tells them to always sit properly. Yeah. And sitting with exactly as described, with the neck and head erect, is better, it facilitates hearing Bhagavatam better. But there are no hard and fast rules. Yes. They're not the most important principles. When they're not overruled by something more important, we can take advantage. I mean, Brahmachari shouldn't give the argument that I have to sit in meditation, I can't go on Sankirtan, or I can't go in the kitchen. I can't do any service because I have to sit. That's a bogus argument. Okay. And the principle is we have to stop running around chasing after sense gratification and sit down in that sense. Like, Krishna gives the example of the tortoise. He keeps his limbs inside his shell until he has to do something. So for service, we'll do anything. We'll run and jump and stand on our heads. But otherwise, we don't do anything. We just sit. Okay? Let me see if I can cover verse 9.
Pranan prapidyeha sayukta cheshtaha kshine prane nasika yochvasita dushtvastva yuktam iva vaharenam vidvamano darayeta pamaptaha.
He should subdue the vital airs in the body and act only as appropriate. As the urges of his life airs gradually decrease, he should practice breathing through his nostrils. The wise person should not be distracted and should work to fix the attention of his mind, which is like a chariot yoked to unsubmissive horses. So this is, according to the commentators, explaining the process of pranayama, of breath control. So that it becomes weak, not weaker, but it becomes subdued, regulated. Just like a devotee has to regulate his sense gratification, not prematurely try to stop everything, but bring his sense gratification under control with the hope that gradually it will subside. Not to exploit the opportunity for restricted sense gratification so that he can continue enjoying his whole life. And maybe at the end I'll become serious about surrendering and about becoming renounced. One should be trying to become gradually renounced and making a serious effort in that direction. Prabhupada says there's danger even on the royal roads. So taking advantage of opportunity for sense gratification in the name of devotional service is dangerous. One should try to minimize material activity as much as possible. That's analogous to the pranayama method of trying to forcibly bring the life air under control so that one doesn't squander his life air and let it run free without any control. One has to make his body strong, sthira, as described in the previous verse, before you can begin seriously this pranayama process. So the asanas are there to regulate the physical functioning of the body, to make yourself healthy and strong, and make your body work in a regulated way. Then when your body is in proper working order, then you can regulate the breathing. Okay. So I won't, there's some description here of the process of pranayama, but we don't have to get into this here. Prabhupada mentions this in the Bhagavad Gita about Purukha Rechika, breathing in, retaining, then breathing out again, so on. Pranayama can be dangerous if you don't practice it properly anyway. These pranayama breathing exercises can actually damage your prana if you don't learn how to do them properly and do them under some guidance. We can practice breathing in and out by chanting our japa. It's our pranayama exercise. I'll read text 10. We'll take a few minutes for that. No, it's going to take too long. There's another Vedanta Sutra commentary here. So, there's any questions?